Been asking a lot of questions, not just this week, but over the past couple of months. Some of those questions are these. What does it mean, actually, that Jesus is King of Kings and Lord of Lords? I say that a lot. It's in the Bible, but what does it mean? What does it actually mean that Jesus sits enthroned at the right hand of God? What does it mean, practically speaking, that Jesus reigns over all creation? What does it mean when Jesus himself says that his kingdom has come? Now, I can tell you today what I have assumed all of that means. But I warn you that all of my assumptions have recently been turned on their head. God has been challenging me and confronting me in ways that, if I'm honest with you, I don't totally appreciate these days. I like those seasons in life when all the questions of faith are answered, when being a Christian is easy, when my own assumptions about who God is and how he works are left untouched. Let me start with how I would have answered those questions a year ago. I actually went back and listened to the sermon I preached a year ago on Christ the King Sunday. What does it mean that Jesus is King of Kings and Lord of Lords? It means that he wins. It means that all the principalities and the powers and the kingdoms and the empires that plague our world have a time limit attached to them. It means that all the evils of the world, all the injustices and hatred and division and poverty and pain, all the evils of the world will be defeated. And that is all still right. That is all still correct. It's the good news that Jesus preached. It's what Jesus' disciples and all the crowds were so excited about. Oppressed by the Roman Empire, longing for the good old days of David and Solomon and Israel's empire, the people heard Jesus. They saw his extraordinary feats of power he performed, and they believed it was finally their turn. They believed they would be the ones in charge. They believed the world would now bow at their feet. And that is the problem. You see, as often as I preach and teach about how God's ways are different than our ways, as often as I preach and teach about how wrong the people of Israel got it, and how sad it is that they missed Jesus because he didn't fit with what they were expecting, faced with my own enemies, my own would-be oppressors, I find that I want exactly the same thing as they wanted. I want God's kingdom to be a kingdom of power, like the kingdoms of the world. I want God's kingdom to be a kingdom of strength, a kingdom that wins because we are stronger than they are. I want Jesus, the king of this kingdom, to be less a suffering servant and more a military genius who's not afraid to rain down terror when it's called for. But that's not the kind of king that Jesus is. Because that's not the kind of kingdom over which he reigns. This week, longer really, but this week I found myself faced with preaching a sermon on the topic. This week, I've been forced to do some honest reflection about how I understand God's sovereignty. And in that reflection, I have to admit that my logic has been a bit off. Here's the way that I've been processing it all. If God is sovereign, if Jesus is King of Kings and Lord of Lords, like the Bible says he is, then he should take care of his people. If Jesus is our king, then it's his job to protect us, to avenge us, to help us. If he doesn't, he's either a bad king or he's not the king. And if he's a bad king or he's not the king, then why do I bother with him? Why do any of us bother with him? What's the point of being a Christian at all? A good king, you see, my logic dictates, will take care of the most vulnerable of his people. Even when it's his people hurting others of his people, a good king will step in and protect the weaker party. It seems like a no-brainer, doesn't it? I'm pretty confident I'm not the only one who's gone down this track. Just look at who Jesus spent his time with. It's all through the New Testament. Look at the way he spoke to those who others ignored and dehumanized. He healed them. He empowered them. He recognized them. Look at the way he spoke to those who had power and influence. He convicted them. He challenged them. He accused them. For me to celebrate Christ the King, I have to believe that he's a good king. And for me to believe that he's a good king, I need to see evidence that he protects and helps those who cannot protect or help themselves. And when I find myself in need of help or in need of protection, and he doesn't seem to be doing what a good king should, I wonder, is he a good king? I wonder, is he a king at all? Is he the kind of king that I want anything to do with? Here's the flaw in my logic, though. I have a particular idea, a particular definition of what that protection, of what that help should look like. So I'm not just expecting my king to protect me or to help me. I'm expecting him to do it in a way that I will recognize as protection or help. And that's the problem. When in the Bible did God's help and protection ever look like what a normal person would expect? Israel, enslaved by a brutal Pharaoh. Eventually, they were free for a moment. And then Pharaoh regretted his decision, and he and his army raced after them. Backs against the sea, the ex-slaves had nowhere to go. There was no escape. So God opened a path in the sea, and they crossed over to the other side, and the army followed them, and God closed down the path and drowned them all. If you were one of those slaves, standing terrified, traumatized, exhausted, an army at your front, a sea at your back, would you in a million years have thought, oh yeah, I know how God's going to get us out of this one. He's just going to part the sea, and we'll walk across. It's unexpected. In the days before there were ever kings in Israel, in those days of the tribes and the judges, the Midianites and the Amalekites, other people groups in the area, the people of the east, they came together against God's people. They, in Judges, were told they lay along the valley as thick as locusts, and their camels were without number, countless as the sands on the seashore. So Gideon, the judge at the time, he sent out a call for fighters to the tribes of Israel, and they responded. Two armies stood face to face, prepared for battle. And then God sent Gideon's soldiers home. And then he sent some more of them home. And then some more, until there were 300 soldiers left. And finally, God sent them into battle. With what? With swords and axes and maces? No, with trumpets and torches they hid in jars. Here's what happened. Gideon's 300 soldiers surrounded the enemy camp as best they could because there were only 300 of them against an army of thousands. It's in the dark of night. As one, they blow their trumpets loud. They smash the jars that hide the light from the torches, and they let out a battle cry. In the enemy camp, there's mass confusion. Soldiers flee into the hills. Other ones grab their swords, and they start hacking away at anybody in their vicinity. They killed themselves. Can you imagine being one of those soldiers? One of Gideon's soldiers. One of the 300 left with a trumpet. Would you in a million years have expected God to help in the way that he did? I don't think so. Peter was imprisoned after Herod executed James, another of the disciples. He's bound with chains. He's sleeping between two soldiers with other guards keeping watch at the door to the prison. And an angel shows up. Peter's chains fall off. The angel leads him out of the prison and into the city to join those who've been praying for him. In Acts 12, where we read this story, we're told right out that even while this miraculous event was happening, Peter actually thought he was just having a vision or a dream. It wasn't until he found himself, the angel gone, standing in the city streets, that he realized it was all real. Even Peter, as he walked out of the jail, didn't think it was really happening. That's how unexpected this help, this protection from God was. Lazarus died and then was raised from the dead.
A little girl died and then was raised from the dead. A widow's only son died and then was raised from the dead. Jesus died and then was raised from the dead. If you're Lazarus' sister, or if you're Jairus, the little girl's dad, or if you're the widow, if you're one of Jesus' disciples, do you expect your loved one to be alive again? Is that the help you expect in your grief? Not in heaven, but in this world? I don't think so. When Jesus was arrested, his disciples expected that God would help. So Peter drew a sword, expecting God at his back, expecting God to protect Jesus and himself, ready to finally see an end to the Romans and the Pharisees alike, expected God to finally show up for the little guy. But God didn't show up. Peter was rebuked for what he did. The soldier was healed by Jesus. Jesus was arrested by the soldier, and Jesus was killed by the soldier or one of his fellows. But we know how the story ends. We know that Jesus had to go to the cross. He had to die so that he could fulfill his mission of conquering sin and death, restoring humanity's relationship with God, with each other, and with all of humanity. God's help was so much bigger in scope than any human being could have ever imagined. It's really not surprising that Peter didn't expect it. How many of us miss God's help or question God's care and concern because the way he helps or the way he cares doesn't look like we'd expect? That's the problem I've faced this week as I've been contemplating the sovereignty of Christ. You see, when I'm honest, I've had to face the truth that I want God's kingdom to be like the kingdoms of this world. I want it to be a kingdom of power and might, a kingdom in which we win because we're stronger than they are. But that is not the way of God's kingdom. God's kingdom is one in which the last are first and the first are last. It's one in which the rules are forgiveness over and over and over again. The rules are love, the agape kind of love, the going to the cross kind of love, not just for those who deserve it, not just for our friends and our family, but also and especially for our enemies, for those who would hurt us. God's kingdom is one in which citizens are expected, required, to turn the other cheek, to give the shirt off their back, to share what they have, not out of their excess, not their leftovers, but their best. God's kingdom is a kingdom of might and power, and we know it is going to be the last kingdom standing when all is said and done. But the way it happens is contrary to everything the world tells us might and power are best used for. God's kingdom was inaugurated by a crucified man who miraculously rose from the dead. To be a citizen of God's kingdom requires that even when we haven't yet seen the resurrection, that protection and help from God in our own struggles, we know, or at least we choose to believe, that the last word will always be resurrection. That's why Christ the King Sunday is so important. Whatever's happening in our world, the end has not yet come, but the end is ensured. Let me say something else about the way God's kingdom works, about the way Jesus enacts his reign. Jesus doesn't do it all alone. Instead, it's Jesus' way to empower us. It's Jesus' way to entrust us with his kingdom here on earth. It's not that he isn't involved. He sent his spirit to empower us, to equip us. His spirit continues to be with us right through to the end. But if we're looking for evidence of God's kingdom, that it's good, that God is good, we will find that evidence not so much in miracles performed by divine beings, but in the lives and the actions of regular, flawed human people. We find evidence of God's kingdom in a Swiss teenager with Asperger's who sparked a global movement to be better stewards of her environment when she decided to sit outside her government's parliament one day instead of going to school. We find evidence of God's kingdom in a Liberian woman's refusal to budge when warlords gathered in an upscale hotel meeting room. I told you about her story, Lema Gbawi, a few weeks ago. We find evidence of God's kingdom in a national commitment to reconciliation led by a South African man imprisoned for 27 years. We find evidence of God's kingdom in a black woman from Alabama who one day refused a bus driver's instruction to give up her seat for a white passenger. We find evidence of God's kingdom in the frustrated Lebanese people linked arm in arm the entire length of their country, protesting the injustice and the corruption of their government. When I struggle with the whole sovereignty of Christ thing, it's because I want my king to beat up their king. It's because I want those who hurt me to suffer, to be defeated. I want God to swoop in and flex his muscles. But the way of God's kingdom is forgiveness, turning the other cheek, loving my enemy. And I have to confess to you, I don't always know what this looks like. I know it isn't about allowing injustice and sin to prevail, but I also know it isn't about fighting those things out of our own place of sinfulness. Because God's ultimate goal, the whole point of his kingdom, is the restoration of all creation. The goal is reconciliation of all people to him and to each other. The goal is not the stomping down of the enemy, but the redemption of the enemy. And the way of redemption is always the way of the cross. It's always the way of forgiveness and love. So what does it mean that Jesus is King of Kings and Lord of Lords? It does mean that he wins, but not in the ways of the kingdoms of this world, not by stockpiling weapons and threatening harm and destruction. He wins by going to the cross, not as a powerless victim, but as one who has chosen the way of sacrifice and surrender. What does it mean to be a citizen of that kingdom? It means that we do like Jesus. It means we also don't choose the way of weapons and threats and beatings, but we also choose the way of forgiveness and sacrifice. It means we refuse to fight like our enemies fight, wielding human power to beat down the weaker opponent. It means we can trust that Jesus is in it with us, though it also means his help will likely be somewhat unexpected.